Board. A couple announcements. So for the Tiny Bucks challenge, that was supposed to be TBC, not TBD. The final design report that was due at the end of the semester, I'm just going to drop that completely. And the testing report, which is the thing where you just insert your measurements and your waveforms, don't really have to write anything, do any analysis. I'm moving that to the end of class, basically, when the final report was due. And that's because it looks like the boards aren't going to be in until later this week. I keep losing my pen. Hopefully that'll alleviate some of the rush at the end. Okay. The other announcement, I'm going to go ahead and cancel class on Wednesday for the site visit. I think we still could hold it, but many of you have assignments related to the site visit. So I'm going to go ahead and cancel that. We'll meet back on Friday. Expectation then is that on Wednesday you are using that time to participate in the site visit. We can get this all worked out. Still have pen. Still have pen. Okay, any questions on that? Tiny box challenge. Okay. If not, one more thing on Tiny Box Challenge. So I'm going to give out these FPGA boards that I mentioned at the end of class today to any group that chose to use them. Did any group not choose to use them? Okay, so I'll give them out to everybody. I haven't posted this to the website yet, but I will shortly after class. This is a Verilog code to program this that I've set up for you guys. So what it does is on this FPGA, it increases the clock from 50 megahertz to 300 megahertz. And then it's got separate modules. One basically works like an analog modulator. One generates the sawtooth, basically just a counter that counts up one count every period of the 300 megahertz clock. That's your sawtooth wave in your analog modulator. And then you compare that to some value to generate something that goes. You count up to 300 clocks and you compare to 150, it'll be high from 0 to 150 and then low from 150 to 300. That's what's generating your PWMs. Okay? So there is this sawtooth and then 8 of these modulator blocks. So if all you want is to get your signals out, all you have to do is go into these modulator blocks, change the value for rising edge and falling edge. And those values are how many clocks before I go high, how many clocks before I go low. Okay. You can set, so it's a 300 megahertz clock. You can set in this max mod value, the maximum value that that sawtooth is going to go up to. So I have it starting at 300 for a 300 megahertz clock. If I count up to 300, that's going to give me a 1 megahertz period. So my switching frequency would be 1 megahertz. And then I have 8 signals that are arbitrary duty cycles and phase shifts with respect to one another within that 1 megahertz period. Okay. If I wanted 2 megahertz, I'd have it only count to 150, double my frequency, and then I'd go through and change timing on all of my waveforms, but they're all within that 150 count. Okay. Does that make sense? So Verilog, something you may not have experience with writing code for FPGAs, but hopefully we don't mess anything up. I don't have any errors in here. You should be able to just go in and change these numbers and get what you want, reprogram it. Now it's going to output those signals. Because there's no requirements on control, you don't need to do anything dynamically. You don't need to sense and change. Just whenever you want to test a new operating point, power down, reprogram, and bring it up. All make sense? Okay. This thing has a specific loader. They've got a whole website with tutorials on how to take the compiled bit file from your Xilinx and then program it onto the device. Fairly simple. But I will post all this to the website with a little bit of explanation and a link to information about this platform and how to program it. Blank stares. Everybody gets it. Perfect. All right. With no other questions or comments, we're going to move on. So last time we ended kind of here where we did this somewhat long-winded derivation of the controlled output transfer function of the ZVS quasi-resonant buck under frequency modulation. And we found that in the end, there was a bit of a difference in DC gain, and that's largely just the units thing. So my gain from 1 hertz to 1 volt is very small because 1 hertz is a very small change in my switching frequency versus my gain from 1 duty cycle to 1 volt is very large because the change in duty cycle of 1 is full scale swing and what I can generate. So because of the units, there's a little bit of a DC gain offset, but otherwise really just barely affected the dynamics of this system. And that's because I have this resonant switch concept, has these different high frequency behaviors, but then I run that through this big low pass filter that just kills everything about that. That was fine, but the analysis was a bit cumbersome. So we run to this issue of, if I go to something that doesn't have a very nice closed form equation that results from my state plane analysis for the output current, how do I go about finding a small signal model of that? And with what we're going to get into, we're also going to go through some analysis techniques that address this earlier problem from a couple lectures ago of what happens when I have multi-resonant circuits that just are not suited at all to state plane analysis. How can I go about analyzing those? Okay. So I'm going to speak a little bit generally here about what we have in power electronics and what we do about it. Okay. So I'm going to review some of the principal nonlinearities that come into play that make analysis of switch mode power supplies difficult. Okay. So the first and main one that defines our field is circuit reconfiguration. Okay. So from the very first time you took class in power electronics, you've seen things like this, right? I've got my buck converter, the switch is in position 1, I have this circuit, the switch is in position 2, I have this circuit. And both of these circuits are nice linear circuits. Okay? When I say that switch is locked into a position, I don't have to worry about this nonlinear element, which is the switch, my main nonlinearity in here, and I can analyze either of these fine. Okay? That's simple. We've been doing that since circuits 1. The problem is, how do I smash these two things together? If I know how to do this and I know how to do this, we don't have any generalized theory about what does a circuit look like if it's one circuit during some time and another circuit during another time, and I want to know the net behavior. Okay? What we do to account for this is we average, right? You got this drilled into you since your junior year. But is that really a valid thing to do? Okay. It's clearly not mathematically the exact same thing, right? We know, and we've looked at, okay, the ripple's gone and things are a little bit different. We have this constraint that with my average model, I only trust it up to about half the switching frequency. So there's some limitations to it. For a lot of what you've done before, we said, don't worry about that. Just average, good enough. Okay. But what are the actual limitations imposed by that? Okay. When we look at, and this is the main one we'll be focusing on, other types of nonlinearities. So there's component value nonlinearities, and we've looked at principally one, the nonlinearity of output capacitance. Again, we have to do something mathematically to account for this. Okay? So we don't have a general analysis framework that accepts nonlinearities. We want things like closed loop transfer functions and simple equations describing circuit operations. We need to find some way to take this into account for really any component value nonlinearity. What we do is we approximate it with some linear value. Okay? Sometimes a more rigorous approximation than others. So with the nonlinear capacitance, we derive these different linear equivalents, which were mathematically correct on one principle value, either the energy at a voltage or the charge at a voltage or something else. Okay, but in our analysis, we're always going to give some kind of, if we're doing any hand analysis, some kind of linear equivalent. If it's, you know, the AC resistance in an inductor, we try to calculate that out and get an equivalent AC resistance. If it's the inductance as it varies with frequency, more often than not, we just say, okay, neglect this too hard, and hopefully it's a small effect. Okay? So now we're going to replace that with a linear value. And then the last one, switching event nonlinearities, which I intentionally call this circuit reconfiguration versus switching, because I want to make a distinction between the net behavior of switching between different states and what actually happens during that switching. Okay, so I just pulled some plot of the switching events, so some hard switching in an IGBT. Whether I'm hard switching or soft switching, there are a lot of nonlinearities that go into that behavior. Okay, when I get to soft switching, I get better because it looks like this resonance. I am, by slowing the DVDT transition, kind of protecting from a lot of the nonlinearities in my device, how that GM current source that describes the channel turns on and varies nonlinearly. I'm somewhat protecting from that. So even my best soft switching converter, during the turn off transition, at least when the voltage starts to rise, the device is not fully off until the gate brings the gate to source low. And there's some nonlinearity that's going to be happening there. Okay. This one, typically, we address with making a high efficiency approximation, I call it, which is that we neglect anything that's going on here, analyze the converter, get our waveforms, get our steady state waveforms, and then go back and just solve this for the losses, assuming my ideal steady state waveforms can be used to describe kind of my initial conditions here. And then I solve the losses independently of my solution for the steady state operating point, right? And that approximation is never truly valid, but it should be pretty good as long as your converter is high efficiency, right? So if I have a 99% efficient converter, then my output current is only going to be, you know, some milliamps higher than what it would be if I had a 100% efficient converter that didn't have these losses. If I have a 70% efficient converter, then I'm going to have significantly higher current here than what my ideal approximation would predict. And then my numbers are off for what my currents are during the switching transition. Okay. Does that make sense? Okay. So we'll look at these. Like I said, principally first here, we're going to look at this circuit reconfiguration and really how to describe that mathematically and where we get this averaging approximation from. So to do that, what I first want to do is review state space modeling, because this is a technique that we're going to be applying. This is different from state plane. This is now going to be this matrix algebra thing where we describe the states and their derivative, right? I'm sure all of you have seen this, but for some of you, it may have been quite a while. If you took 481 here, we don't really emphasize this section. So just a quick review. If I have some circuit that consists of reactive elements, and let's just say that's something like this, inductor, capacitor, voltage source, current source, something we've looked at heavily in our state plane analysis. From this circuit, I can write two equations, two differential equations, one for each of the two states in my circuit. My states are voltage on capacitors, current and inductors. States are things that somewhat have memory that depend on the time history of the waveforms applied to them. So the voltage on a capacitor depends on the current that's gone into it from time zero up until now, right? It's not an instantaneous function of what's going on in the circuit. It's an integral of the current that's been applied to it back to the beginning of time. Capacitors were there in the primordial ooze accumulating voltage. So my two equations here for my capacitor, C dVc dt, In this case, it's equal to IL minus my DC current. And for my inductor, L DIL DT is equal to V minus VC. Right. And both of these can generally be written in a form where I've got a derivative of some signal is equal to some coefficients times that signal plus some coefficients times my independent inputs. So I'm going to define my vectors here. I'm going to call X my states. That is V sub C and I sub L. And I'm going to call U my independent inputs. That is V and I. And I'm going to have something times U, something times IL. If I add all that stuff together, what it's going to give me is the derivative of my two states. Okay. So if I remember how to do matrix products, look it back up, make sure I remember how this whole thing works out. But so my equation here, my equation for the capacitor voltage derivative is going to be kind of in this top row. My dVC dt depends on the inductor current state and the DC output current. So it's going to not depend on its own state. So this first term, I multiply, I'm going to get this space times VC plus this space in my 2x2 matrix, this space times IL. So my equation dVC dt has no dependence on VC. I put zero here. And it does depend on IL. How I've written this, I need to divide my capacitance over and my inductance over. So I'm going to have 1 over C here. Okay. And over here, I'm going to have no dependence on the DC voltage V, and then a minus 1 over C multiplying current I. Okay. Same thing for IL. Taking this equation, I'm going to have minus 1 over L, 0. I'm going to have a 1 over L from V and 0 here. Okay. All right. So, generally, we write this as X dot, which is all of this, which is my state derivatives, is equal to this thing is X, which is my states. This thing is U, which is my independent inputs. This thing we normally call B, and this thing we normally call A. And these two things are matrices that describe circuit connections. These are the ones that are really giving me the topology of my circuit. Right. So this allows me to describe really any linear circuit. And I can solve this equation, which we'll look at a little bit later, mathematically for how the states progress. I can do that analytically. I can do that using a numerical solver pretty easily. MATLAB has some built-in functions where you can just give it a state space and it'll spit out the solution. More generally, if I was using something like Simulink, or if I wanted to look at this as a block diagram, what it would look like is I have my states X, which would be this vector of my instantaneous time values for all of my states. If I take that and send it through this function, x dot is equal to ax plus bu. I pull in my independent inputs u. I'm going to multiply x by a, b, or u by b. What I get out of that is x dot, time derivative of my states. And if I take the time derivative and run it through an integral, I get back the states themselves. Okay. So the function of it looks like this. I've got this kind of continuous loop, and I have two paths by which I can influence my output. Okay. So the first is my states propagating through and changing over time. Okay. Generally called the natural response of the circuit. How do the states respond to themselves, essentially, without any inputs affecting things? Then I have a path where my inputs can change and then propagate through and affect things. That's called my forced response. I have both of these going on. You can think of, if I set I to zero, V to zero, but had initial conditions on L and C that weren't zero, and I just let this thing go, it's going to ring. That's its natural response. Okay. If I put a step function in V, then that's going to alter the waveforms. That's going to be the forced response. Okay. All good. It's all coming back. Everybody remembers this stuff. Well, if you don't, now you know. Okay. So to look at what we actually do when we model a switching circuit, I'm going to use the buck converter as an example. I'm going to try to keep my notation fairly general so that it'll be applicable to any kind of two-state converter, but at times I'm going to jump in and show the actual results for the buck. Okay. So my buck converter, split it into these two different switching subintervals, subinterval one on the left, subinterval two on the right, and I can describe either of these circuits fairly easily using state space equations. Okay. So for subinterval one and two, I'm going to again define my states as V sub C and IL. V sub C on top, which is arbitrary. I could do it the other way, wouldn't change a thing. And my independent inputs now, I just have one, the input voltage VG. Okay. So let's write the equations for these two circuits. Here on the left, what I'm going to have is X dot is equal to something times X plus something times, let's still call it U. U is VG. Okay. So my top row is going to be VC. DVC DT is IL minus V over R, where V is the capacitor's voltage. So it is going to have a dependence on its own state. It's going to be here. I'm going to have minus 1 over RC. So it's C DV DT is equal to minus V over R. I divide that C over, get minus 1 over RC for that. Okay. And then plus 1 over C for my dependence on the inductor current. And that capacitor is buffered from VG by the inductor. not connected to it, so I'm gonna have zero here. Okay. For the inductor current, LDI dt is VG minus DC. So I'm gonna have a minus one over L, no dependence on itself, and one over L dependence on VG. No issues so far? Okay. Over here on the right, times X, all vector times U. Okay, so what changed? Just this connection here. My state connection to one another didn't change at all. The only thing that changed is I no longer have VG connected at the left side of L. So that's going to cause this term to go to zero. Everything else is going to be the same. Okay. So now I have descriptions of these two circuits. I'm going to more generally write this as X dot is equal to A1X plus B1U. And over here, X dot is equal to A2X plus B2U. Okay. Where A1, A2, B1, B2 are the matrices above them. Okay. So I need to combine these two things together somehow to describe the net circuit operation. In order to do that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to define a new signal. I'm going to call it delta of t. And delta of t is going to be my switching signal. It's going to be high between 0 and DTS and low the rest of the time. It's going to go between 1 and 0. Write it as kind of a piecewise thing here. Delta of t is 1 when NTS is less than T is less than N plus DTS. 0 when N plus DTS is less than T is less than N plus 1 TS. Okay. So just being general, for any period, any number of periods in N between 0 and DTS of that period, it's 1, the rest of the time it's 0. Okay. So this thing really tells me which state I'm in, right? And I could say more generally that my X dot is equal to this type of equation, but whether I use A1 and B1 or A2 and B2 depends on the value of this thing. When this is 1, I'm going to use A1 and B1. When this is 0, I'm going to use A2 and B2. So if I multiply by delta of t here, then I'm going to get this thing during its appropriate subinterval, and then it's going to get multiplied by 0 and disappear during the rest of the time. To do the same thing for the second subinterval, I'm also going to find delta prime of t is equal to 1 minus delta of t. Okay. So similar things going on here to duty cycle, but duty cycle is describing a single value, the percent of that period that I'm in one switching state or the other. Delta of t has this time dependence. It's actually telling me I'm 1, you're in switching position 1. Okay. So if I want to bring these two things together, what I'm going to do is write X dot is equal to A1 if delta of t is high, or A2 if delta prime of t is high, times X plus same thing. This might be Okay. And this is where things start to get fun. This thing mathematically is a bit of a mess, right? My x dot and u are all potentially time varying things, and now I have this time varying function delta that's multiplying in there, and I've got something that's heavily nonlinear, and I need to come up with a way to get some linear expression out of this. Maybe I'm okay with approximating. So what we normally do at this point is we average. We're power electronics guys. We don't like nonlinearities. We like averaging, so we average. Okay. So if I take this and I average these things in the square brackets, what I'm saying is, being in this state for DTS and this state for D prime TS, looks like if I smash them together, weighted by D and D prime, being in that thing for the whole time. Okay. So this will reduce down to, I'm going to add together kind of a weighted sum of A1 and A2, and I'm going to weight it by the percent of the period that I'm in each of those states. That ends up being is D times A1 plus D prime A2 is X plus D times B1 plus D prime B2 times U. Now, my whole thing is linear. Okay, I've gotten rid of this product of time-varying terms. I got all my pulsating functions out of here. So, hey, great. Got rid of these delta of T things, which I didn't like. Problem is, mathematically, is this well-founded? Is this a valid approximation? How much error have I introduced by making this approximation? That thing is, I don't know how accurate that is. I haven't proven that this thing is a good approximation under any conditions. I just say, okay, well, I don't know what to do next with this, so let's average it. Okay. We'll look at what that error looks like in a moment. First, I want to come in and see what happens when I do this with the buck converter. So I'll jump back to specifically for the buck. X dot is equal to, okay, DA1 plus D prime A2. Hop back here. A1 and A2 are the same thing. So I can pull out that D plus D prime. That's one. So this whole thing is just going to be this matrix. Minus 1 over RC. 1 over C. Minus 1 over L0. Times X. Plus DB1 plus D prime B2. I'm going to have 0 d over L plus 0. I'll go ahead and write my U as BG. Okay. So here is my average state equation for the buck converter. Just to see what we have here, I'm going to break this apart into, you know, back into my two equations for CdVdt and LdIdt. So this gives me dVcdt across the top row is minus Vc over Rc plus IL over C was nothing from VG. And then DIL CT is equal to minus VC over L plus VG times D over L. Okay. If I wanted to say what is the steady state response, now that this thing is average, there's no kind of within the period time varying nature to it. I'm not jumping between different states. So I'm not switching anymore. My steady state response is just going to be wherever this thing stabilizes, the D by DTs are zero. So if I do that, if I set this thing equal to zero, I can cancel my capacitance. Set this equal to zero, I can multiply by L, still zero over there. What I get is some not for the surprising things here. IL is equal to V over R. V is equal to DVG, where V is my DC value for the capacitor voltage, jumping from VC to V, just so if these equations are more immediately recognizable. These are the equations we get from any type of averaging we do on the buck, right? This is what I would get from my volt-second balance and my cap charge balance. Okay, so no surprise here. So we now, that extensive experience in the past with waveform state averaging using just the waveforms themselves. We went briefly over switch averaging. We were looking at these resonant switches. Do state space averaging. All three are really mathematically the exact same thing. It's just what you like looking at, how you like working with equations. Okay. So this, same thing we've been doing for a long time. Okay. So fine, we can do that. The next question is, what happens if I start to want to look at a small signal model of this system. Okay. So I'm going to go back to the top line here before I applied this averaging assumption, which at this moment is still dubious. We don't know whether I can do that or not, other than, well, I have been doing it for a couple of years, so it must not be too bad. But we haven't proven that that's an okay thing to do. So I'm going to start from back up here. And I'm going to look at what happens if I want to derive my small signal model of this. Okay. So, as always, there's two ways we can do that. We can perturb the system, make all my states, the state plus state hat, small signal perturbation on top of the DC operating point, and then linearize by only taking my first order terms. Or I can do a Taylor series expansion to first order. This thing is kind of messy, so I'm just going to go ahead and perturb and linearize. Okay. So I'm going to take this equation, x hat is equal to delta of t a1 plus delta prime of t a2 times x plus delta of t V1 plus delta prime of T V2 times U. And I'm going to perturb and linearize. So first, I'm going to say all of my signals, X is some X plus X hat. My penmanship is not great enough for you to be able to tell that this is a capital X, but things without hats are DC things now, okay? And I'm going to do that for everything that is potentially time-varying, okay? So that's going to be my X hat, my delta of T, my X, my U. All those things I can perturb, I can change, okay? So if I do that, what I'm gonna end up with is, oops, yep, is that what you guys are looking at me weird? That should still be just a dot. So this would be x dot plus x dot hat. See if we can add in something else where I can get x dot hat bar squared is equal to, and here I'm going to perturb delta of t. What that's going to give me is delta of t plus delta hat of t times a1 plus the perturb delta prime of t. I'm really just perturbing delta of t still, but delta prime is 1 minus delta. So what I'm going to end up with is delta of t minus delta hat of t, delta prime of t minus delta hat of t for my perturbation there on A2. And that whole thing is going to multiply x plus x hat. Then I'm going to have the same kind of thing for my second term. Delta of t plus delta hat of t times b1 plus delta prime of t minus delta hat t times a2, b2 times u plus u hat. Okay. So I've only done the perturb step. Second thing I'm going to do is linearize. So now I've got example terms in here. I'm going to have a u hat times a delta hat. My assumption in my small signal approximation is that I'm looking at a very narrow region around a DC operating point. And as long as I'm not at a discontinuity of the system, if I look at a small enough region around some operating point, it's going to be well approximated by just the linear components of that. No matter what function I have, if I zoom in enough where I'm just looking at a very small section, it looks like a line, as long as I'm not on a discontinuity, but some boundary case. The other thing I'm going to do is I'm going to separate my steady state equations and my dynamic equations. So my things that only depend on the steady state capital variables and my things that depend on the hat. Right? So around here I did my perturbation. Now I'm going to linearize, or I'm going to just eliminate second order terms. So what I'm going to get is my steady state and then my dynamic solution. My steady state I'm going to have is x dot is equal to, same thing from the previous slide, I had before I perturbed, just all of the steady state variables, the same equation up at the top. What I'm more interested in is my dynamic response, my small signal linearization. That's going to look like x dot hat. And I'm going to have, as we just looked at when we did the ZVS quasi-resonant buck, I'm going to have three terms multiplying my hat variables. So I'm going to have something times x hat, something times u hat, and something times delta hat. And those somethings, those coefficients, are all going to be steady state only the DC operating point terms, right? Because I've gotten rid of any terms that multiply two hat variables. Say, I look linear, all those second order terms, they don't matter because I'm in such a narrow window. Okay. So if I do that, what I end up with, well, So go through, let's do the x hat term first. So it's going to multiply x hat. I'm not going to worry about any of these delta hats because they're going to go away as second order terms. I'm going to have delta of t times a1 plus delta prime of t times a2. Multiplying x hat plus, let's do u hat next. I'm going to get same kind of looking thing, but with b's, delta of t times b1 plus delta prime of t times b2, multiplying u hat. And then my delta hat term. So this plus, I'm going to have delta hat times a1 minus a2 times x, delta hat times b1 minus b2 times u. So this is going to be a1 minus a2 times x plus b1 minus b2 times u is delta hat of t. So this is my first order small signal response, okay? So I avoided so far doing any of this averaging, okay? So far everything is mathematically well-founded. The only approximation I've made is this linearization. And I know that that is mathematically well-founded. I look in a small enough window and I'm not on a discontinuity, that works, okay? I know that introduces some error, but only if I go far from the DC operating point. That accurately describes the behavior right at the DC operating point. So far, no approximations other than the one we have to make, this linearization. Okay. So what does this thing look like? And I'll take answers beyond a mess. So if I look at this, these things look real similar to what I've had this whole time, right? Look real similar to what I started with. This is the response of the circuit to changes in states, changes of input. And if I linearize it, it looks pretty much the same. It still responds to these the same way it does to large signals or small signals. This thing is new, right? How it responds to changes in my control, changes in duty cycle, essentially. Okay. But it kind of makes some sense. Look at delta hat on the next slide. But let's say I have some small increase in duty cycle. What's going to happen is, compared to my steady state, I'm going to stay in state one a little bit longer. I'm going to be in state two a little bit less amount of time. Both of these terms are describing linearization of that. Okay, my steady state would have told me I'm in A1 for this long and A2 for this long, but instead I'm going to be in A2 a little bit less, A1 a little bit longer, and I'm going to propagate according to AX plus BU. And because I've linearized, I depend only on steady state. Okay. So what I want to look at briefly here is, what is this function delta of t? Okay. So, well, delta hat of t, define delta of t. So if I call my delta of t something like this, my delta of t versus time, it's got a value of 1, goes down to 0. Okay. And I perturb that. I'm perturbing my duty cycle. Depends a little bit on what I do for modulation, but I'll assume I've got some leading edge modulation and I increase my duty cycle a little bit, nor any differences in this, those are both one. This thing would be my delta of T plus delta hat of T, my perturbed duty cycle. So if I want to know what delta hat looks like, I just subtract these two. Delta T plus delta hat minus delta T is delta hat of T. Looks something like this. So this perturbation signal that I'm sending in is zero everywhere except right at the edge, right at my switching instance. It's some narrow pulse. Okay. And with my small signal linearization, what I'm saying is I'm looking at a very small perturbation. I want to be right around the DC operating point. I want this to be limit as the amount of duty cycle I change goes to zero. So if I do that, what's going to happen is this pulse is going to narrow. And in the limit, what this becomes is just a single impulse function. So I have no time associated with it. I just have this minor pulse that tells my duty cycle to change by a specific amount. That amount, the area of this thing, is however much I wanted the duty cycle to change. If I wanted it to change by d hat, I need to have a difference in these two waveforms of c hat. And this thing has got to give me an area of d hat ts in order to change the duty cycle that much, right? If we have any signal guys, any digital control guys out there, they're real comfortable with these impulses. The rest of you may not be. You've probably seen them, but this thing is not something you really want to work with. But the interesting thing about this is I've got a signal that's zero everywhere except for at this one specific time point. Okay. And when I say if you're digital guys, you're comfortable with this, is it comes up all the time. This is a sampler. Okay. So this has a value only at this one specific time point. And if I multiply this purple curve by any signal in the world, as long as it has a value of one right here, I get the same thing back. Okay. There's an inherent sampling type nature of this. And that's going to lead into how we model this thing. We'll pick up there on Friday. Please, as I said, participate in current activities on Wednesday. And we'll see you back here.